Hey, you are listening to a podcast from resistradio.com for Tuesday, the 3rd of July, and I'm pleased to be again joined by Tom Secker. Now, Tom's been very busy because it's obviously coming up to the anniversary of the 7/7 London bombings, the 7th anniversary, in fact. And this week, Tom has put out a couple of videos and also an article. So we're going to be discussing that today and maybe get into a few other things like the upcoming Olympics and the various conspiracy theories around that. So welcome to resistradio.com, Tom.
Hi, Britt. Good to be talking to you again.
Yeah, it's good to talk to you as well, Tom. So like I say, you've been very busy. You've put out quite a lot of material in the last few days. And I would like to talk about that because it's obviously a very good time to get the information out. So you've put a couple of videos out. One of them was 7/7 in 7 minutes, and the other one was 7/7, the key evidence. So let's talk about 7/7 in 7 minutes first, because at the beginning of that video you refer to the fact that the official narrative about 7/7 is quote, a mess of contradictions, misreporting and conjecture. So maybe for the first bit of the show, we can get into some of those contradictions and misreporting and conjecture.
Yeah, sure. I mean, there's a million and one examples, really. You could, if you were really into this stuff, you could go through that document, that Home Office narrative now, and just, like a teacher, draw red pen through half of it. The most well-known example is the train that the four alleged bombers supposedly caught from Luton train station to actually get into London before they supposedly split up and blew themselves up. And according to the original narrative as it was published, they took the 7:40 in the morning train from Luton station. But by the point that this narrative had been published in May 2006, it had already been long established from multiple different sources and multiple Freedom of Information requests that there was no 7:40 train that morning. Mm-hmm. It's simply unforgivable that they put the wrong information in about that, because it's such a simple detail. And I think that's one of the reasons it's become so well known, and why so many people kind of are aware of this fact that the train that they're supposed to be on never actually ran that morning. Is just because it's such a fundamental thing. I mean, how do you get something like that wrong if the process is honest? So that's probably the most well-known example. Mm-hmm. But there's all kinds of things in there. There's stuff about the time when they walked into Luton Station. In the original publication of the narrative, it was said that this took place at 7:15, I think. But the problem with this is they included part a single frame from the CCTV from Luton Station, but they've cropped the time code out, and the time code actually says 7:21. So why it is that they, you know, cropped out the part of the image that contradicts their timeline, their narrative of events, I don't really know, but it's pretty dishonest. Mm-hmm. And obviously, a lot of people have claimed that that image was faked, but I don't necessarily think it was. I'm very much in the camp that says that CCTV probably is authentic, but what does it really show? It shows four lads with rucksacks walking into a train station and catching a train. I mean, yeah. You know, so what? Every CCTV camera outside a train station every day on, you know, every town in Britain could probably capture the exact same thing. Mm-hmm. So I think it's probably authentic CCTV. It's just, you know, meaningless in evidential terms. And of course, the way in which it's been handled is, it's almost like it's been there to generate suspicion with putting out this initial single frame image of these four guys, where you can't really identify any of them because the image quality is so poor. There are some signs that if it hasn't been faked, it's been very badly copied. Mm-hmm. If you know what I mean, you've worked with digital media, you know what it's like. Digital reproduction isn't in any way a smooth and perfect process. Mm-hmm. So why did they put out this really badly copied image in the first place? Was it precisely to provoke people into saying this image is fake, those guys were never there, so that they could, a little bit further down the road, 3 years later, they actually give you the full run of the CCTV, which doesn't look faked, mm-hmm. And is probably authentic. So the whole way in which the CCTV has been handled has been kind of deceptive from start to finish, and pretty unpleasant, I think. I do suspect with that it was for that purpose, that they were trying to generate a particular kind of reaction that would just take people in the wrong direction. So they were looking at the wrong things.
Okay. Well, let's stick with 7-7 in 7 minutes, because you go on to talk about the two intelligence and security committee inquiries or meetings. And you talk about the first meeting and the problems with that. Maybe you can just go into that a little bit more. You talk about the fact that video surveillance of the alleged bombers weren't shown to people at that inquiry. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, the first, there was two different reports from the ISC. The first is in May 2006. It was published alongside the Home Office narrative. And the second one, due to trials, basically due to legal proceedings, wasn't actually published until May 2009. Mm-hmm. But I think it was actually finished in late 2007. Anyway, in the first inquiry, they basically said some of these guys turned up on the periphery of another investigation, but we never really had any information on them. We never identified them. They were never subjects of any kind of targeted surveillance operation. Basically, they were just sort of guys that we now realize we'd come across briefly before. Mm-hmm. So there was nothing untoward. There was nothing MI5 could have done differently. It then emerges in the Operation Crevice trial of 2007, which is about a year after the publication of the first ISC report. We find out that, in fact, this was the biggest counterterrorism operation in Britain before 7/7. It went on from early March 2003 to about April 2004. So, you know, it was a really long operation. It involved lots and lots of surveillance of lots of different people. It ultimately led to this trial where I think seven guys in this country were put on trial for conspiring to use fertilizer to blow up any number of different targets. What emerged in their trial is basically that during the course of this massive surveillance operation, 2003-2004, that they came across at least two of the alleged bombers, particularly Mohammed Sadiq Khan, the supposed ringleader, but also Shehzad Tanweer to a certain extent, that they'd come across these guys on multiple occasions. They'd followed them up to Leeds from areas around London on two different occasions. Mm-hmm. They had video footage of them. They had photographs of them. They had number plates that they'd traced to cars belonging to these guys or in their names or rented in their names and things. Mm-hmm. So none of this was hinted at even in the first ISC report, which is flabbergasting. I mean, how on earth did they not know this?
It is quite incredible. I mean, there is that footage of a group of men walking along past a load of, I think, fast food shops. Two of them are clearly Khan and Tanweer, so it was obvious that they were under surveillance. And yeah, for that to not be brought up is very puzzling indeed. Now, you go on to talk about the second ISC inquiry and the fact that basically during this second inquiry, MI5 produced an inaccurate timeline. And what you suggest this led to was basically a kind of an obscuring of the relationships between the bombers and several other different men. I think this is a very important aspect of the whole thing. And what I would like you to do is maybe to talk about some of these rather mysterious characters that have been connected to the alleged 7/7 bombers. And I'm talking about people like Martin McDade and Junaid Babar and this guy who's known as Q. You suggest quite reasonably that these people could be agents or some kind of intelligence assets. And, I mean, this does lead to the distinct impression that, you know, this was entirely set up and there were these people who were kind of provocateuring and acting as mentors to these you know, what were basically impressionable young lads. Well, I would say three of them were anyway. Khan was a bit older than the other three, but they were definitely young and, you know, could have been easily impressionable, and maybe these guys were influencing them. Maybe we can start with Martin McDade. Could you tell us a bit about this character?
Well, right. I mean, McDade turns up in the story of the ICRA bookshop up in Leeds, where you're living now. Mm. it's no longer a bookshop, sadly. It's turned into some sort of, I think it's a one of those, you know, lawyers who turn up at accidents, that sort of thing. And the ICRA bookshop was running from about 2001, maybe, till it was raided after 7/7, and it kind of shut down then. And it was a bookshop and learning centre and sort of a charity. I mean, it had the ICRA organisation had charitable status and was funded with public money, to the tune of quite a lot of money. I think we're talking about £100,000 over the period of several years. I mean, you know, that's quite a lot of money that's gone through that place. Mm-hmm. And Martin McDade was basically the guy who was running it. He was a white convert or revert to Islam. He claimed quite widely, even boasted, of having been a former British Special Forces soldier. He said that he was in the SBS, the Special Boat Service, mm-hmm. And that he'd left that and subsequently turned into a Muslim. And he is, by all the accounts of the people who knew what was going on at ICRA and other people who worked there, other people who were involved, McDade was the one who was really kind of vehement and aggressive in his promulgation of Islam, in his militancy, in that it was very just very aggressive in the way that he approached the subject. Mm-hmm. And that if anyone there was an extremist, it was Martin McDade. Now the problem with all of this is other people who worked at the bookshop included Muhammad Sadiq Khan and Shahzad Tanweer. They were actually trustees of the charity for a period of well over a year, and during this period McDade and the bookshop, to a certain extent, were the subject of security service investigations, of MI5 and West Yorkshire Police Special Branch investigations, because they say McDade first came to their attention way back in 1998. Exactly how, we have no idea. Then in 2001, they launched a surveillance operation codenamed Warlock, which basically followed McDade and several other men to the Lake District, where they did a, quote, terrorism training camp, unquote. And one of the other people who was also there was Muhammad Sadiq Khan. And Khan was actually caught on video camera during the surveillance of this training camp, of whatever the hell it was that they were actually doing in the Lake District.
Yeah.
And there were several other trips after this, which were also surveilled by MI5. And they, I think they caught Tanweer at one of them. They caught him on camera at one of them. And none of this really led to anything. None of this led to any sort of arrests. And though they made attempts, or say they made attempts, to identify the other men that were at these camps, and you're talking 40 or 50 men ultimately, they said they identified very few of them and they never noticed Sadiq Khan and they never knew anything about that. Okay, maybe that's true. Maybe it isn't. But then in early 2003, in I think April 2003, McDade was specifically targeted for a couple of days of surveillance. MI5 asked West Yorkshire Police Special Branch to follow him around for a couple of days and basically see what he was up to. Mm-hmm. During this surveillance, he is seen getting into a car which is registered to Muhammad Sadiq Khan, and this car gives him a lift for a few minutes and then drops him off somewhere. And we know that it was registered to Sadiq Khan, and we also know that West Yorkshire Police found this out because they ran a check on the number plate and got the name Sadiq Khan. Apparently they never told MI5. They claim they never told MI5, and MI5 say they never received this information. Mm-hmm. But when they were asked about this at the inquests, the guy from West Yorkshire Police basically says, well, it wasn't really in the it wasn't in line with the operational purpose. It wasn't in keeping with what we were actually trying to do. Mm-hmm. They never explain what the hell it is that they were trying to do. they just say, oh, that wasn't, you know, we didn't hand on the name because that had nothing to do with the purpose of the operation. And they said, so it wasn't really, you know, considered important enough. And basically, like, no, it wasn't important enough. Mm-hmm. But it was important enough for them to carry out an immediate check on that license plate. I mean, literally, they did 2 days of surveillance on McDade. And the first day after that's finished, they carry out this check on the registration number. So it's important enough for them to think, we immediately need to know who this guy is, but not important enough to tell MI5, who've requested this whole surveillance operation. I mean, that just doesn't add up. It's not, you know, it doesn't make sense to me. Then they run an investigation into the ICRA bookshop at the end of 2003. They discover that it's a registered charity, that McDade is running it, that there's this other guy called Tafazul Mohammed who is also involved there. They say that at that point they never realized that Tanweer and Sadiq Khan were trustees of the ICRA bookshop. But the problem with that is their name was on the paperwork. Their name was on the paperwork filed with the Charities Commission. And so if they had carried out an investigation into this bookshop and found out that it had charitable status, the only real place they could find out about its charitable status would have been the paperwork with the Charities Commission, which has Sadiq Khan and Tanweer's names on it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So again and again, we have this pattern of, oh, we didn't find out that information. Oh, that information wasn't shared, or we didn't realize who was in this photograph. And what this pattern of different intelligence failures shows fundamentally is that the relationship between McDade and, in particular, Sadiq Khan, but also Tanweer, was obscured by these so-called intelligence failures.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's the sort of general pattern that runs throughout that whole story. And it's a similar thing with the other two characters, but we can get on to that. I'll try and be briefer. We can get on to that in a minute.
And you include in the video this clip of obviously somebody who knew McDade talking about the fact that he got the distinct impression that McDade was kind of influencing and even grooming, is the word that he uses, these young guys, which is very interesting. And is it right that he's basically kind of disappeared as well? Or what's happened to McDade? Because he's obviously a central figure to the whole thing.
Well, I mean, if you just sort of slap the McDade timeline, compressed version of the timeline, he's known to the security services from 1998 onwards. He is the subject of several surveillance operations and investigations that mysteriously fail to really uncover that much about him, and fail to uncover his relationship with the alleged 7/7 bombers. His name is leaked to the Times newspaper in, I think, 2002 as a possible extremist. The security services are giving his name to the Times newspaper, saying, we think this guy might be a, you know, Islamic extremist. Mm-hmm. Is that about, you know, creating credibility for him? Is that about, you know, sending a journalist goes up to Leeds and starts walking around going, do you know this McDade guy? Isn't he an extremist? Mm-hmm. He's never arrested. He's never arrested as part of the 7/7 investigation, even though he's wandering around in the days after 7/7 giving interviews to the Mirror and things like that. Never arrested by the police. He's never, as far as we know, even sort of interrogated or questioned by them. The whole timeline, just sort of the whole story, if you like, adds up to, was this guy working for the security services? And you're right, the guy's now disappeared. He was last heard of in Oman, I think, teaching English at some foreign, you know, Omani school that teaches English as a foreign language. And that was 2007, maybe 2008. No one's heard of him since then. Mm-hmm. So where he is and what he is and what he's doing now, I don't know.
Okay.
But you know what I mean? I mean, you've read about a lot of these characters. That sort of thing just sounds familiar. There is, you could take that same story and apply it to, oh, I don't know, Ali Mohammed is quite a similar one, although he was actually ultimately arrested but then disappeared. But he was a guy who was sort of running Al-Qaeda in America throughout the whole of the 1990s. Mm-hmm. And working for the CIA. I mean, we know he was a triple agent. We know he worked for the CIA and the Special Forces and the FBI. But then again, if McDade is to be taken seriously, he's a former Special Forces soldier. Now, I suppose it's always possible that a former British Special Forces soldier might turn up in Leeds and might be ranting and raving about Islam and happen to know a bunch of guys who then get framed as the alleged terrorists.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, maybe that's possible. But the far more likely explanation is that that guy was there on some kind of spying mission, and that, you know, given the other evidence that those four guys have been framed, that they didn't actually do it, the most likely explanation for McDade is he was part of this process of framing them.
Has anyone been able to find out any more information about his previous career other than what he's said himself in terms of his career with the Special Forces?
Well, it's never been denied. They wouldn't necessarily admit it, but it's never been denied. No one's ever been able to get, you know, like a copy of any military record that proves this. So he may have been making that up, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, the whole thing could just sort of dissolve into smoke and mirrors.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, there is always an inherent degree of uncertainty in this because of the incomplete nature of the information. I'm not saying I know 100% that that guy was a spy. I'm just saying, having gathered all the documentation, all the media reports, all of the television interviews with people who knew him, all of that kind of thing together, and, you know, just sort of spreading it out and looking at it, the most likely explanation is that he was a spy.
And some kind of provocateur, yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this other character who is probably even more suspicious than McDade, and this is the Junaid Babar guy, sorry. And this is the guy who, immediately after 9/11, basically flew to Pakistan or the Afghan-Pakistan border and made a distinct point to appear in front of the television cameras, basically threatening American troops if they came to Pakistan, he would murder them and things like this. And yeah, there's all kinds of very dubious things about this guy, isn't there? And it's pretty obvious that he was working for the intelligence services. Maybe you can pad that out a bit and tell us a bit more about him.
Okay, well, Mohammed Junaid Babar, he's born in Pakistan in, I think, 1975, comes to America in 77, so when he's just a kid. He grows up in Queens, New York. He goes to a Catholic military school. rather curious place for a, you know, Pakistani American to be going to school. But he then, in the late 1990s, he works in a series of petty jobs. He even admitted to defrauding some of his customers when he was what's the name of the guy who gets your car when you turn up at a restaurant and he goes and parks it for you? A valet.
Valet, that's it.
Yeah. Yeah, when he was working as a valet, he apparently defrauded some of his customers.
Okay.
He then joins Al-Muhajirun in New York. Now, Al-Muhajirun is this sort of international organization that exists largely in Pakistan, Great Britain, and America. And pretty much everywhere it goes, it seems to be riddled with informants. So he joins Al-Muhajirun in New York, this sort of radical Islamic organization, if you like. But they don't add up to very much. They just sort of turn up on the streets waving the odd banner about Osama bin Laden. They're not really, you know, doing anything of any great significance.
Mm.
But it's because he joined Al-Muhajirun that, or at least so we now know, that's when he first comes to the attention of American law enforcement. So this is before 9/11.
Yeah.
So, okay, then 9/11 happens. Junaid Babar's mother is working on the, I don't know, 9th or 10th floor of the World Trade Center. I think she was a cleaner. So she nearly dies in these attacks.
Yeah.
Yet mysteriously, Babar is so kind of captivated by this that he decides to run off to Pakistan to join Al-Qaeda.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, maybe he didn't like his mother. So he goes to Pakistan. He gets involved with Al-Muhajirun in Lahore, in Pakistan, and also he works for the Pakistani Software Export Board, which is a sort of agency of the Pakistan government.
Mm.
That's up until about the end of 2002 that he's doing that. He then apparently gets a bit bored with all of this. It doesn't seem to be adding up to very much. When he gets to Pakistan in November 2001, he gives these interviews where he talks about killing all the Americans he sees in Afghanistan and killing all the Americans in Pakistan if they come there. And,
yeah,
you know, all of this sort of extremely inflammatory and obvious stuff.
That's it.
By the end of 2002, he seems to have got a bit bored with Al-Muhajirun and what have you, not really going anywhere. So he sets out off to join Al-Qaeda, and he sets up a training camp in Malakand, in Pakistan, in the frontier border region of Pakistan.
Mm-hmm.
Among the various people who passed through this camp, and pretty much all of these people who did have subsequently ended up in court on terrorism charges,
mm-hmm.
Mostly with Junaid Barbar being the prosecution witness against them.
Yeah.
but among the various people who did pass through this camp were the whole bunch from the Operation Crevice plot, or at least several of them. So you have Omar Khayyam, Salahuddin Amin, several others from this Crevice plot. And this is in the midst of this big surveillance operation that's going on in Britain. These guys fly out to Pakistan and go to Junaid Barbar's training camp, right?
Yeah.
And several of the other people who also turned up there included Mohammed Sadiq Khan and one of three men who knew Mohammed Sadiq Khan, who was prosecuted as part of the 7-7 conspiracy, but ultimately acquitted. Mm. But again, Barbar was the main prosecution witness against these guys.
Yeah.
This is in mid-2003. By March 2004, the Crevice operation is being wound up. They are starting to get ready to move in on these guys and bust the whole thing up and arrest at least some of them. And in early March 2004, Barbar flies back to America. He isn't arrested when he lands. He hangs around at his home for about a month before the FBI approach him. Nothing's happening to him, even though he's given all these statements and made a big fuss about how radical he is.
Yeah.
The FBI then just sort of approach him outside his house. They just sort of walk up and start talking to them. He immediately agrees to go into their custody. And he immediately flips and becomes a cooperator.
Yeah.
And for the next several days, he basically tells them everything about what he was up to in Pakistan.
Yeah. So the obvious impression is that he was working for them all along.
Well, the BBC brought this up. In fact, not just the BBC, the Times newspaper did as well. That when Barbar testified in the Crevice trial in 2007, when that finished and five out of the seven guys he was testifying against were prosecuted successfully, were convicted and given massive prison sentences, there was then some reporting restrictions on this stuff was lifted, and the BBC did an episode of Panorama called Real Spooks. You can find this all on my YouTube channel. Where they go into the whole case and explain everything that was known, at least at that point, about what was going on. And even the BBC say, inevitably, there was this suspicion that Barbar had been working for the Americans all along. Even the BBC. that's what we knew in 2007. By now, we've had a whole lot more stuff because, for one thing, Barbar's testified in a few more trials, so we've got a bit more information about what he was up to and when. But most critically, he has now been sentenced and released. He is now a free man. He served about 4.5 years in prison.
Yeah.
And then they announced, slap bang in the middle of the July 7th inquests, that he was he'd been sentenced to time served and was now free.
Yeah.
Whether that was about generating some controversy, or whether that was about almost trying to bury the story because it was in the middle of the inquest. I mean, I don't really know. Why did they pick that time? Why did they schedule it then? I don't believe it was by accident. But I don't really know what they had to gain by announcing this then in the middle of December. So in the middle of the inquest.
Okay. So just to move on, there's one more character called Q. How does he fit into all of this?
Well, Q was kind of the overlord, if you like, of the Crevice fertilizer bomb plot. He is the guy that MI5 first got information about, that he was an Al-Qaeda facilitator in early 2003. They started investigating him, and because of that, they uncovered Omar Khayyam and the rest of the supposed plotters.
Yeah.
The problem is, Q himself was never arrested. He was never called as a prosecution witness in the Crevice trial. He was never called as a defense witness in the Crevice trial. Now, if this guy is central to the whole plot, why isn't at least one side of that trial trying to get him on the stand to talk about it?
Mm-hmm.
Probably because they didn't know where he was. He'd disappeared by this point. But even the BBC, again, even the BBC asked the Deputy Assistant Police Commissioner, Peter Clark, who features quite a lot in my films and my videos, because he is the kind of main, or was the main counter-terrorism bobby in London. The BBC even asked him, you know, was this guy working for you? Was he working for Special Branch or MI5? And the guy sort of goes, no, I can't answer anything of that nature. This is just complete speculation. Why not just say no?
Yeah.
I mean, even if it's untrue, why not just say no?
Yeah, that was pretty dodgy, yeah.
And anyway, one of the connections that turns up is between Q and Sadiq Khan at the ICRA bookshop. When MI5 first started to investigate Q, so they say, a few months into this investigation, according to the timeline that the ISC, going back to this timeline in the second ISC report, which is kind of where we started 20 minutes ago, according to that timeline, it was in, I think, July and August that they first got detected some calls between one of the phones that Q was using and a phone that they traced to M. Sadiq Khan, or Sadiq Khan, up in Leeds. The problem with this is that the document that they made available at the inquests has that check on that phone that leading to the name Sadiq Khan taking place much earlier, taking place in early March. And this is supposedly before the Operation Crevice investigation had even formally begun. Mm-hmm. And they kind of asked, some of the lawyers asked about this at the inquests, but obviously because it's quite a technical thing, it got a bit lost in the transcript. But basically, MI5 said, yeah, the subscriber check did take place in March, did take place earlier in the year. Months before we told the ISC that it did, but that was just an honest mistake and we were confused about our documentation because our paperwork was a bit shoddy. Mm-hmm. And when the ISC looked at this in their annual report of 2010-2011, they basically accepted this excuse. They just said, yep, fine, we believe you.
Okay.
And it seems no matter what MI5 tell the Intelligence and Security Committee, the ISC just say, yep, fine, we'll write that down. Doesn't matter if it contradicts what we've said elsewhere in our report.
Yeah.
I mean, I get into this briefly in the article, in the Seven Documents article, which is that when on one of the occasions that they followed Khan from down in London up to Leeds, this happened at least twice. Once is on the 2nd of February 2004, and a few days later, MI5 emailed West Yorkshire Police to say, do you have any information on the registered owner of the car, which was Haseena Patel, Sadiq Khan's wife, and this address in, I think it was Thornhill Park Avenue in Leeds, which was Haseena Patel's house, but it was where this car, driven by Sadiq Khan, was seen to stop at the end of this surveillance. And the ISC were evidently told three different things by MI5 about whether there was any response to this email that they'd sent to West Yorkshire Police. Firstly, they said, we never got a response. We have no written record of any response. Then they said, West Yorkshire Police did a search, but they didn't find any information. They also told them West Yorkshire Police did a search, but they didn't find any significant information. So that's three different stories that MI5 have told them.
Mm-hmm.
And they can't all be true. In fact, only one of them, even if any of them are true, only one of them could be true to the exclusion of the others, logically speaking. Mm. And as you might imagine, West Yorkshire Police did get back to MI5 about this quite quickly, and there is no reason, you know, the way the email is labelled and everything, there is no reason why they shouldn't have been able to find this when the ISC came to ask MI5, you know, what are your documents, what's your record on these different investigations? There's no reason why MI5 shouldn't have found this response from West Yorkshire Police. It's nuts. Okay. And in any case, yeah, the police did respond. And they did have information about Haseena Patel, but most of the email is redacted. So exactly how significant this information is, we can't be certain. But the point is, you know, MI5 told them three different stories, and at least two of those stories are comprehensively not true.
Okay.
And again, the ISC just sort of said, yeah, well, we accept that this was just an honest mistake.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Well, at this point, Tom, I would like to ask you what your gut feeling is about all of this and what you actually think happened. I mean, I know it's not possible to assert anything because we don't really have the evidence to make any firm assertions, but what's your real feeling about this? What happened? Because I know you've said before that you don't think these four guys did it. Can you maybe explain what you mean by that and what your personal theory would be about what happened on 7/7? I know it's a big question, but...
No. Well, I'll answer the parts of it in a way that I'm happy to answer them. I don't think those four guys did it because fundamentally the evidence getting into the 7/7, the key evidence video, there are seven bits of key evidence that the Home Office cite saying that these four guys killed themselves in these coordinated suicide bombings. And each bit of that evidence is twaddle. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense. It doesn't fit with the other documents and other exhibits that they've published. It doesn't fit with other official statements. It doesn't fit with what witnesses say. Basically, for example, they say that the evidence from the bomb sites is that DNA has identified the four at the four separate bomb sites, and that the impact of the explosion on their bodies suggests that they were close to the explosions, close to the bombs when the bombs went off. Mm-hmm. Now, firstly, close to? Surely they would have to be in possession of the bombs to be suicide bombers. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's almost like they're using deliberately ambiguous language there. I don't think close to is quite certain enough, is it? I mean, surely if the guy's got a rucksack bomb and he blows it up right in front of him, it's going to show that it's blown up right in front of him, not just near him. Mm-hmm. The question of DNA evidence is a bit problematic because of in two of the cases in particular, with Sadiq Khan and Shahzad Tanweer, they are saying that the only testimony is that these guys found the police after the bombings found small pieces of these guys, you know, like shreds, literally chunks of them. Mm-hmm. But the bodies were then, or at least the bodies of the four alleged bombers were then sent to a forensic anthropologist, someone with no explosives expertise, someone with no terrorism expertise, someone who'd never done any investigation into suicide bombings. And she was the person who determined that these guys were likely close to the bombs when they went off. That's where that little bit of information comes from. But aside from her lack of expertise, which she openly admitted to at the inquests, she's not claiming to be anything that she isn't. She said, you know, I'm not a terrorism expert, I'm not an explosives expert.
Yeah.
But her descriptions of the bodies that she was reassembling and looking at were much more complete and intact than the descriptions of these pieces of bodies that were supposedly found at the scenes. Mm-hmm. On top of all of that, you have the doctors that were sent out to the bomb sites to pronounce the people dead in both Edgware Road with Sadiq Khan and Liverpool Street with Shahzad Tanweer. They only found the supposed victims of the bombings. They never pronounced dead a body belonging to a suicide bomber, or at least another body that could presumably be a suicide bomber. So we're then left with the question, basically, were these guys ever there?
Right.
Were they ever on those trains and that bus? Because mm-hmm. the story of how their bodies were identified and recovered and then analysed for the damage to them, that whole story doesn't add up.
Mm-hmm.
And so therefore I'm left with this possibility that, like I say, those guys just weren't there blowing up bombs. And if they weren't, then obviously someone else, I'm not quite sure who, but someone else must have been. Go on.
Yeah, I was just wondering, I mean, I'm not sure, but how much do you think that's a possibility in terms of percentages? I mean, roughly, I mean...
I wouldn't want to stick a number. What specific question are you asking me? The question of how likely it is that those guys just weren't there.
I'm asking how much you believe that they weren't actually at those sites, at the bombing sites.
I'm a lot more certain of it than I was a couple of years ago, because at that point we didn't really have this information. We didn't really have any account of how these guys were, you know, identified through DNA, or how their bodies were looked at for their explosive damage or anything like that. So at that point I was essentially ambiguous towards it. I was sort of, well, it's possible their bodies were actually found there. Even that wouldn't prove that they were suicide bombers, of course, but you know, it's possible that this claim is true. But then we got the inquests, and I was looking for the specific evidence from these inquests about this particular issue. And when I looked at it, I just thought, this is, I mean, it's laughable. It doesn't make any sense that they're saying we recovered this small piece of muscle tissue from Khan's body, and we found this 30 centimeter long chunk of Tanweir's spine. But she's describing bodies that have arrived in for her to examine them that are essentially not completely intact, but not blown to smithereens. She said she reassembled all four bodies, I think, in less than 3 days. Now, if they're blown to smithereens, it would take much longer than that. So, yeah, that case just doesn't stack up. And because that doesn't stack up, and on top of the question about the CCTV, there's no CCTV that shows these guys anywhere near that bus or those trains.
Yeah.
I'm very much tipping towards the, I get more certain as time goes on, that those guys just weren't there. That they were somewhere else when those bombs were going off.
So what do you think happened to them then? I mean, there's obviously the theory about these people that were supposedly shot at Canary Wharf, which I don't think you put a great deal of trust in, because there's not really much evidence for that. But what could have happened?
Well, there isn't really any evidence that anyone was shot at Canary Wharf. I mean, something happened at Canary Wharf. There was a lockdown there. But let's not forget, in 1996, Canary Wharf was bombed by the IRA. It's a pretty obvious terrorist target. And from my understanding, there was a lockdown at Canary Wharf, but that was simply because it's one of those sites that gets locked down whenever there's a terrorist attack in London. There isn't a single witness that saw anyone get shot. And the whole notion of, I mean, why would they shoot them on the street in Canary Wharf?
Mm.
Why not just arrest them and shoot them somewhere else in secret?
Yeah.
Nothing about that's ever rung true for me. But the basic idea of them being somehow lured or provoked into taking this trip to London wearing backpacks for whatever reason, and then being intercepted, most likely at King's Cross Station, because they sort of seem to get to King's Cross Station, but then the CCTV goes blank for about 25 minutes, about half an hour. So maybe the most likely thing is something in that period, those guys were, you know, interdicted or intercepted by someone. And we can only presume they're dead. I mean, there's never been any evidence that they're not dead.
Mm-hmm.
Unlike with, you know, so-called 9/11 hijackers. We've never had any equivalent reports for 7/7 suggesting that they're still alive. So the basic idea that they were lured to London, then intercepted and then somehow disposed of, entirely possible. I just think the specific details that have been put out by 7/7 Ripple Effect and Nick Collerstrom, I think their sort of specific version of that focuses on some pretty shoddy and pretty weak evidence. The basic story may well be true.
Okay. So, I mean, the question would be then, why would it be easier for whoever did this to do that rather than just have these guys carry the bombs, or at least be next to the bombs on the tube trains? Why would that be more difficult than somehow intercepting them and then killing them and disposing of their bodies?
Because of it being subject to basically them figuring it out, if you give them actual bombs, they might check in the bags and find they're carrying actual bombs. Whereas if you tell them they're delivering, I don't know, speculating here, tell them that they're delivering drug money, then you give them a bunch of money in a bunch of rucksacks and tell them to deliver it to different places across London. They all travel down to London. You then intercept them and take them off somewhere and whatever, shoot them, blow them up. I don't know. It's far easier to get them to do that, because then if they do check the bags full of money.
Okay.
So as far as they're concerned, everything is right. I mean, this is all hypothetical, but yeah. That's why you would do it that way rather than run the risk of... I did explore the hypothesis of a sort of unwitting suicide bomber, a suicide bomber who doesn't know he's carrying a bomb, which is a real thing. I mean, this has happened in certain instances of terrorism in the past. But in this case, I don't think it makes much sense. And also, the whole notion of attacking the tubes and attacking a bus with suicide bombers, whether they realize they're suicide bombers or not, that doesn't make any sense because they're soft targets to begin with. It's not like trying to blow up the Prime Minister. It's not like, you know, I mean, that's traditionally what the point of suicide bombers has always been, is to try and attack something that you wouldn't otherwise be able to attack. That's where terrorist suicide bombing first came from, with the assassination of the Tsar in Russia in the 1880s. You wouldn't use it to go and blow up a tube train and kill half a dozen people. Because why, if you like, why sacrifice one of your terrorists in order to accomplish that when you could accomplish the exact same thing just by leaving a bag on the tube train?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I am kind of hypothesizing here in several different directions, but basically what I'm saying is my approach has always been just to collate as much evidence on any given question as possible, look through it all as honestly as I can, and then think, well, what's the likelihood here? What makes sense? What has an internal coherence about it in terms of a possible story that's different, you know, an alternative explanation? And also, just does this sort of add up? Does this make sense in terms of how would you do this if one were trying to plan and carry out that sort of false flag attack?
Okay. So you don't think, or you suspect, that they weren't on those tube trains and bus? What would your speculation be as to what they thought they were involved in?
I don't think they were involved. They thought that they were involved in a terrorism training exercise. That whole thing with Peter Power, just there's no evidence that these guys ever met Peter Power or had anything to do with Visor consultants, or they'd never told anyone that they were involved in an exercise. There's absolutely nothing except the existence of these interviews where Peter Power talks about running an exercise that in any way connects them to that. And since we have no corroboration that there even was an exercise running that day, we just have Peter Power telling us that there was. It's just a really weak hypothesis. However, the notion that they were somehow recruited and thought that they were taking part in whatever, drug deal, I don't know, something like that. Maybe they thought that they were working for the security services. In fact, maybe Sadiq Khan was actually working for the security services. It would explain why he keeps getting surveilled in all these different operations, yet they never arrested him. I'm not at all sure about that, but there's a distinct possibility that Sadiq Khan was actually working for the security services. So if they were recruited into something like that, some kind of dummy operation or sting operation that then got flipped around, or, you know, something like that, again, distinct possibility. If you look at Oklahoma City, there is this whole thing about the PatCon sting operation, infiltration operation of the sort of radical survivalist right. And that somehow out of that we got the Oklahoma City bombing. The exact way in which one turned into the other isn't certain, but it's pretty clear that there's a connection there.
Mm-hmm.
Similar sort of thing with 7-7, I reckon, that you have all of these MI5 operations running in the 2, 3, 4, 5 years before 7-7. So many times they come across these guys, yet never seem to do anything about them. Sadiq Khan in particular is connected to McDade, Barbar and Q, all of which are likely intelligence assets or spies of some kind. The much more likely explanation, rather than the Peter Power exercise, you know, dummy terrorists thing, is that these guys were somehow recruited by the security services, possibly with them knowing it, possibly without them knowing it. I think that there's just a lot more evidence for that kind of hypothesis than anything to do with the Peter Power exercise.
Okay. Now, I mean, the Peter Power exercise, that's kind of used by a lot of people who research the alternative theories about 7-7. And I think your kind of take on that has maybe brought you into some kind of conflict with some of these people. Is that right?
Brought me into an awful lot of conflict. I keep getting accused of working for MI5.
Yeah.
Even though I'm saying I think Peter Power's a distraction and the much more likely culprit is MI5.
Yeah.
For some reason, people seem to think that means I'm working for MI5.
Yeah.
You know, make sense, make whatever sense of that you can, but whatever. No, I think it's possible that this is a setup, a distraction, a deliberate red herring, if you like. That would be my explanation, if you like. I'm not saying I'm at all certain about this, but again, it's just, what do I think is more likely? You have a guy who goes on TV and radio voluntarily telling people about this exercise, voluntarily kind of bigging it up and saying, oh yeah, we were, it was all to do with the exact same stations.
Yeah.
And then he sort of starts to go, well, it wasn't exactly the same stations, or it wasn't all of the same stations, it was some of the same stations, but some of, you know, some that weren't, and the scenario wasn't identical, it was just very similar, and you know, I didn't pick the date and time of when we were doing it, the client did, and the whole thing becomes fudged. No one's really sure where to go with this and what's truth and what's lies, and again, it's smoke and mirrors. And, and so that's what I have come to the feeling that that's what the whole purpose of the thing was.
Yeah.
There may not have even been an exercise. There probably was, but there may not have been. The purpose of it was simply to give people a sort of ready-made conspiracy theory, boil-in-the-bag conspiracy theory that they could then take away and say, oh, it's all about the exercise, that's how the attacks was done, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
And when you look into the history of these similar exercises that were done on the tube and what have you in the months and years before 7/7, the point of them doesn't appear to be to prepare for a terrorist attack. The point of them seems to be about preparing the public. It seems to be more psychological. And so, therefore, following that logic through, is the purpose of the Peter Power exercise actually psychological rather than, you know, about physically carrying out an attack?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, this issue, it does raise interesting questions about how certain people take hold of an idea, and that becomes like a central tenet of a theory. And if you challenge it in some way, then you're seen as some kind of heretic or an MI5 operative, as you've been accused of being. And it's just interesting because I've seen people so many times referring to things like saying that basically there were 1,000 people involved in this exercise, which is complete misinformation. That's simply not the case. Peter Power was doing this exercise on behalf of a company who had 1,000 employees. But there are so many people who talk about this kind of stuff that just repeat these details that are simply completely false.
Well, and they repeat the old one about, oh, it must be several squillion, billion to quadrillion to one chances that this could happen. Well, not necessarily. I mean, the tube is a pretty obvious target. It's not like with 9/11, where no one had ever carried out a terrorist attack like that before. The tube has been bombed lots and lots of times, you know, sometimes simultaneous bombings for over 100 years before 7/7. So the basic idea of an exercise of terrorist attack on the tube is much more kind of normal, if you like, than the notion of planes being hijacked and flown into buildings. And obviously there's more than one exercise is being run within the space of, say, a year than just Peter Power's one. But people have said, oh, you know, the chances of him running it at 9 o'clock that morning, and that's pretty much at the same time as these terrorist attacks happen. I mean, that must be hundreds and thousands to one. Whereas if they're actually running an exercise about once a month, and certainly in the months before 7/7, they were doing it about once a month, then you've actually got a 1 in 30 chance of getting the right day. Or if you limit that to weekdays, even less than that. Mm-hmm. So I'm not saying it's tremendously likely. I'm not saying it's all just a coincidence. I'm just saying that the statistical likelihood has been massively exaggerated. Sorry, the statistical unlikelihood has been massively exaggerated in just the same way that this working for a company of 1,000 people has become a 1,000 person on the street exercise.
Mm-hmm. I think that was first, that statistic was first published in Ripple Effect, is that right?
No, actually, it's first in Alex Jones, it's in Terraform.
Oh, was it? Okay.
Yeah.
And it was then repeated in Ripple Effect.
Yeah, just Lock, Stock and Barrel, he just stuck the same number in his film.
Okay. So, I mean, what's your take on Ripple Effect, because I know there's a Ripple Effect 2 coming out, which I've seen the trailer for, and to be honest, it strikes me as being pretty sensationalistic, and they also include a bit of fear-mongering about the upcoming Olympics, which is another issue that you're interested in, because you've just written an article about the conspiracy theories about a possible attack on the Olympics. So what's your sort of take on Ripple Effect 2 that's going to be coming out?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's apparently going to be first broadcast on the 7/7 anniversary, which is also my documentaries are being broadcast on satellite channels on the same day.
Okay.
So if you have satellite TV, have a look at Paradigm Shift TV and Edge Media and what have you, if you want to watch slightly higher quality versions than you can get on the internet. My take on Ripple Effect is that there is this whole story about how that film came into being that just isn't true. And this is the story that John Hill, a.k.a. Muad'Dib, it's the story he's told. He says that he basically made this film in about 3 weeks, and that he did it all himself, and it was just that he somehow came across this information and thought this was the most likely explanation of what actually happened on 7/7. But the truth is, it was going on for months before that, and there are emails proving this. It involved more than just John Hill. The likelihood is he wrote and recorded the voiceover and someone else actually did the visuals, and I expect the same thing is going to be true of the second film. And so his explanation of sort of when and how he made this film, it just isn't true. And proceeding from that, when you look at what's in Ripple Effect, when you look at the basic story that's being told here, it focuses on Peter Power, and the only real evidence that it cites for this is a ridiculous statistic from Alex Jones's film and Peter Power's own interviews. There's no other corroboration. It says that these guys were likely murdered at Canary Wharf on the basis of a few rumors buzzing around and a few anonymous people writing on the internet. I mean, it's just, it's not in any way taking the most strong evidence and most strong case that we can make that there's something desperately wrong with this.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to almost be taking the weakest evidence and the stuff that is so obviously ambiguous and therefore could be part of a disinformation smoke and mirrors campaign.
Okay.
And to kind of sum it up, I've done a lot of analysis of 7/7 conspiracy theories in fictional media, both before the attacks in the form of predictive programming and after the attacks in terms of how did the official story then get fed back into entertainment shows and books and whatnot. And I'll say this, every single way in which the predictive programming set up an alternative theory of 7/7 before it happened, because it didn't just set up the official theory of suicide bombers, it also promulgated ideas of potential alternative conspiracy theories before the bombings, and every single one of those then appears in Ripple Effect. and quite a lot of the ones that appear after 7/7 in different episodes of Spooks and whatnot, where they're obviously, you know, coming up with a storyline that's sort of based around 7/7 conspiracy theories, pretty much all of those also end up in Ripple Effect. And the icing on the cake, perhaps, is that the same time that the people around John Hill who were helping him make this film, the same time that they first got in contact with the July 7th Truth Campaign, was the exact same time the BBC first got in contact with the July 7th Truth Campaign about their Conspiracy Files show, which used Ripple Effect to a massive extent.
Okay, very interesting.
I'm not saying that that all adds up to John Hill is a disinformation artist. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying bear these possibilities in mind and actually look into this information, because it's all there if you want to find it.
Yeah, and don't invest everything in one theory, which is often, you know, can be proven to be wrong. It's a very important point. Well, Tom, we're coming up to the hour, and I think we'll draw it to a close there. But there's been some great information to come out during this chat, and I would like to thank you again for coming on ResistRadio.com. And maybe you can tell people where they can find your YouTube and website, and anything else you want to plug. Go for it.
Well, yeah, sure. My two new 7.7 videos are called 7.7 in 7 Minutes and 7.7 The Key Evidence. You can find both of them on YouTube, freely available. They're also available as podcasts and as transcripts to try and make it as sort of easy and accessible as possible for people to get this stuff and share this stuff. Because I have tried with those two videos to compress the thing right down much more than I've been able to in this interview. Yeah, you can find those freely on YouTube. My YouTube channel is youtube.com/77archive, which has lots and lots of 7.7 related media on it. And my website is investigatingtheterror.com.
Excellent stuff. Well, thanks again, Tom, and I'll no doubt speak to you again soon.
Okay, cheers, Britt. Thanks for having me on.
Cheers, Tom. Bye.